And now the new antenna's working out fine.
Hey, sounds like they are fixable at least once. And maybe you could have fixed it again, but you gave up because somebody gave you another one. The price is right. I like that price, F-R-E-E. Good luck with that operation, Eugene. I think we've answered everyone's questions. Mel, what kind of mail have you had this week? And here I was this week making sure I was going to give lots of gaps to make sure that all the people who want to sign in through the Internet could do so. I've been hearing reports that there were guys from California, Tennessee, Oklahoma, and Maine, and Texas trying to sign in last week. You and I were so quick on the switch, they didn't have a chance to do it because we'd have to wait until everything drops to the Internet connection to get picked up. These guys ended up talking to each other by text messaging each other through the Internet connection that they had because they weren't able to get through to us, and they were saying all kinds of words about us, about how quick we are with the switch. So I was going to make sure that they had an opportunity this week, and Murphy's Law dictates that the Internet is not there this week. K2KEY, K2RIW, you got it, Mel.
Case, this is K2KEY. Yeah, fine business, huh? Well, yeah, some of these emails, I just started looking at them. Some are a little bit on the hilarious side, some are a little bit on the, what you would say, not repeatable on the air kinds of comments. But I'm looking over to see something here that we can, okay, here we are. I have a problem with my dipole. I can't get it to, haven't got enough room to stretch it out completely. When it comes to bending the ends of the dipole, is it better to bend them horizontally, vertically, or what? Does it make much of a difference which way I bend the dipole? In other words, which way should I droop it? That's a good expression. Which way should he droop the ends of his dipole, Dick? Over.
I'm going to express my opinion on this one, Mel. You've been doing that also over the years, and then you're going to express your opinion, and the guy's going to be lucky enough to get both opinions, and he can decide which one he likes. Whenever you and I see a picture of a dipole in a book talking about antennas, whether it be the license manual, the ARRL amateur manual, the ARRL antenna book, whatever, almost always the dipole is shown as a pure horizontal straight piece of wire with a feed line in the center, with rare exception. From that, a person who is not super familiar with radio circuits will think that anything but a straight piece of wire set up like that, anything else is not going to work well. They can easily get that impression. I can tell you for a fact that the radio signal that you put on that antenna is amazingly forgiving. Because you don't have enough space to stretch out the wire all the way, you've got four or five choices. You can make the wire shorter and reestablish resonance with loading coils at the center of the antenna. You can take the wire itself and zigzag it along the whole length. You can take the wire along the length and wrap it into a spiral. You can take the wire at the ends. You can bend it left, right, up, down, any way you want. You can flare arc out the end with a capacitive top hat. These are all techniques for mechanically shortening the antenna, but yet re-resonating it. Or you can even choose not to re-resonate the antenna at all. Just put you wanted to put up 132 feet of wire on 80 meters, and you've only got 105 feet of space. And you put up 105 feet of wire, but you got a low enough loss feed line and a good wide-range antenna tuner to reestablish resonance. So you can re-resonate the antenna by bending the tips of the wire up, down, left, and right, flaring it out into a capacitive top hat, spiraling the wire along the length, zigzagging the wire along the length, putting loading coils at the bottom, the middle, the top, anywhere you want. There's a zillion ways you can mechanically shorten the antenna and make it re-resonate. The first thing the guy's going to say is, what's going to happen to the antenna efficiency? Isn't it going to go to hell in a handbasket?
Repeater, time out.
And the answer is absolutely not. Once you resonate the radiating system, which consists of your antenna tuner, the feed line, and the antenna. Once you resonate that system, as long as you've used reasonable quality materials, you put 100 watts into the antenna, and 99 watts is going to be radiated somewhere. Now, if the antenna is real close to the ground, a certain amount of it's going to be coupled into the ground and wasted. You can't blame that on the antenna. You can only blame that on where you put the antenna and what nearby lossy materials you put in the near field of the antenna, the local earth. As you zigzag the antenna, as you spiral it, as you put loading coils, as you put top hats, as you bend the end up and down, you'll make an extremely minor change to the antenna pattern. You'll be amazed how little you change it. If the major axis of the antenna is north-south, then the majority of the radiation will be broadside, east and west. No matter how you zigzag it, up, down, left, right, along the length, only at the tips, loading coils, all the things that you do, or don't do anything. Just make 105 feet of wire and re-resonate it with the antenna tuner. In all of those cases, you're going to get within 95% the exact same gain, the exact same efficiency, as long as you've used quality materials. The RF is nowhere near as persnickety as you think. Now, back in the days when we didn't have antenna tuners, and where the antenna was the wrong length in the wrong location, and you had a 3-to-1 standing wave ratio, and your transmitter would go into a cutback mode if it's a solid-state, non-tunable transmitter, and you'd end up putting out the only 1 watt of power instead of 100 watts, because your transmitter went into a self-protect mode. Yes, I'll admit that that's a pain in the neck to live with that kind of a condition. But once you've got a good, properly operating antenna tuner, that problem goes away. I think there is nothing magic about the ends of the antenna, whether you tilt it up, down, left, or right. If you tilt the ends down and the ends come closer to the earth, the rate of detuning will happen a little bit faster and a little bit more energy will be coupled into the earth and you'll get a little bit more loss. But if you made a careful measurement of bending them down versus bending them up, without some pretty precise laboratory test equipment, I don't think you'd be able to see the difference in efficiency. Nowhere near...
Repeater, time out.
That phenomena is nowhere near as sensitive as you think. That's my opinion. Now, you're a guy who has set up a 160-meter dipole, 260 feet long, by stretching it across the front yards of multiple houses on your street. You're a guy who really squeezed a very long, very low-frequency dipole in a difficult environment, and to the best of my knowledge from what I'm hearing from you, it's working like a charm. And that's a pure horizontal dipole, and there's nothing wrong with vertical dipoles, as we talked about before. So I think you're discovering that a dipole is a hell of a lot more forgiving for all kinds of mischief that you and I are capable of doing. As long as we use the right materials and we know what we're doing, it's going to work. And the dipole is not that expensive. If you don't like the first one, put up a second one and a third one. Make the first one north and south, and the second one east and west, even though your property is not as wide east and west, and you have to squeeze it down a little bit more. Because they're so inexpensive, and you can flip back and forth, and depending on which dipole you talk to, which state of the ionosphere, which guy you're talking to today, having multiple antennas is always a lot of fun. These are some of my opinions. Let's see what Mel's done along these lines. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Yes, Roger, this is K2KEY. Well, my 160-meter dipole, it's pretty straight, but it's got some little, you know, movement that I had to pull it over a little bit this way and that way because of the tree situation. But I've had dipoles up there that if you look down on them from space, you would look like a big Z of some sort. In fact, here's a question I'm just looking now. I just took the advice of what you just said. I put up a dipole for 80 meters, and I had to do some zigzagging, and I'm feeding it with 450-ohm open-wire feeders into an MFJ open-wire balanced input-type tuner, open-wire feeders into the tuner, and I notice when any movement at all, more than a few kilohertz on 80 meters, I have to retune. Why is it so critical that I have to constantly touch it up over?
Every dipole at 80 meters, depending on what your criteria is for good standing wave ratio. If you're a guy who always wants the antenna to through the transmitter like a 1.1 standing wave ratio or better. But that's your criteria. A full flat-out dipole mounted 100 feet in the air on 80 meters is going to have you retuning every time you move 50 kilohertz on the band. As you make the dipole physically smaller and re-resonate it by whatever means, your antenna tuner, zigzagging, whatever, as you make the antenna physically smaller, the bandwidth of the dipole does come down. But every dipole, depending on your criteria, is going to have a certain bandwidth, and you're going to have to do a certain amount of retuning every time you move in frequency. That's a given. And modern-day solid-state, no-tune transmitters are quite persnickety. A number of them, if you exceed a 1.4 standing wave ratio, it goes into some kind of a output network power protection by either cutting back the power, turning itself off entirely, lighting up a flashing light on the front panel. It does something. Some of the modern-day no-tune transmitters are very sensitive to standing wave ratio, and therefore without an antenna tuner, life is kind of difficult. But again, the fact that you've got to readjust the antenna tuner every time you do a little bit of QSYing, every antenna has some of that. And depending on how much you've physically shortened it, it gets a little worse. Depending on where you've mounted the dipole, as the dipole is closer to the ground, closer to other metallic objects, anything you do that starts shielding the dipole raises the Q, makes the bandwidth become more and more narrow, where you got to retune sooner every time you QSY. I think that's kind of normal. It's something you got to get used to. One approach to the problem would be you make yourself a chart that when I'm on this frequency, I tune the dials that way. That way you can go right straight there to it if you're manually tuning. Or you can set up some kind of a computer program where the machine doesn't have to find the solution. You tell it the solution and it goes there immediately. There are ways you can speed up the process during a contest operation, but every time you QSY, the antenna is automatically tuned to the right frequency. But I think to some degree, every antenna is going to do that. K2KEY, K2RID.
Repeater, timeout.
Okay, very good. Yeah, I do the same thing. I have a chart. My loop antennas I use on 80 meters. Of course, I'm going across quite a bit of territory there, going from the CW portion up to the through the sideband portions up to about 3,800 and maybe up to 3,850 or so. So I have a chart to where the dial settings once they were determined. And the easiest way to determine that is instead of using your transmitter and trying to key it up and see where the points are that the loading points are, if you have one of these handheld analyzers, you can substitute the analyzer in and just watch the SWR indication on the analyzer and make yourself a chart that way. This way you won't be creating any QRM or problems or worry about running a high SWR using your modern-day transceiver. So that's what I usually suggest doing. In other words, use the dial settings. They usually have a calibrated dial setting. And by using the handheld SWR type of devices, sold a number of them on the market, they will be able to give you extremely good indication. You don't have to worry about, how much time, how much heating you're doing. Rig, Dick, over.
So, by way of that external SWR meter, which I think you're putting between the transmitter and your antenna tuner, you're able to at a low power level, set the tuning dials exactly right so that the antenna looks like close to a 1-to-1 standing wave ratio into the transmitter. That's what I think you're doing. Now, if you were not using your antenna tuner, if your transmitter was going raw straight into that antenna, no matter how you tune that antenna, even if you set it up at 3750, right in the middle of the band, it is my guess that when you go down to the low end of the CW portion, 3500, or the high end of the sideband portion, 3995, my guess is your dipole would be hitting at least a 3-to-1 standing wave ratio. Your full out half-wave dipole on 80 meters. I'll bet you it would be hitting a 3-to-1 if you were not using an antenna tuner. Am I approximately in the ballpark here, Mel? K2KEY, K2LIW?
Oh, yeah, no doubt. I believe an antenna tuner, it should be in a line because, like you say, that dipole is, no matter how method of you thinking of, you know, making it broadband, it is still going to be and, you know, going to start to, the FWR is going to start to really climb up when you start to go across a band such as the size of like 80 meters. As I said, that one of those handheld analyzers, those antenna analyzers, actually will put a signal out on that frequency, whatever the dial, you know, the readout says on there, and it indicates the standing wave on the meter there, or if it's a graphic type like. I prefer the graphic analyzer put out by AEA because I can look basically from the sensor frequency, I can look at the how the antenna looks across both sides of the tuned frequency. It gives you a nice, you can expand out the scales to whatever you like, and it'll scan across all that territory and gives you, as you see it on the graphic display. But there's nothing wrong with these ones that are individual frequency at a time. And looking at that, you can then play with the knobs on your tuner. In other words, you're substituting the handheld analyzer for the transceiver deck over.
That AEA graphic analyzer sounds like a fun machine. From the time you press the on-off button until you get a graph across that screen that tells you from 3.5 to 4.0 megacycles what your graph looks like, how long does that take, Mel? How real-time is it? And does it update fast enough that it's easy for you to twist the dials and therefore you know you're going to operate at 3850 right now and you twist the dials until 3850 gets nulled out on that meter? Depending on how fast that meter responds and gives you a new graph, how long does that take? So as you can see, I got two questions there. By the time you first turn it on cold, how long does it take to get a graph? And how fast is it able to update the graph as you're twisting the knobs on your antenna tuner? K2KEY, K2RIW.
Okay, now, when you put it on, for instance, a band like 80 meters, and you want to set it to sweep the entire band, it takes a few seconds. You can see it moving across, analyzing, and sending the data back to the graph. If what you do, in other words, you may open it up, you can set, you know, the amount of sweep you want. Let's say that, your antenna looks fairly, you know, within reason, like you say, varying from 3 to 1 down to 1 to 1, then going out 3 to 1 and all. And you say to yourself, well, okay, let me start, I see that it's staying flat, like you said, 50 kilohertz either side of the point of the antenna. Then you say, well, okay, let me move out that 50 and then see how much I have to touch up the tuner. Of course, the analyzer would be keep sweeping. So what you do now is you shut it down to zero so that you set the analyzer now to that frequency, say 50 kilohertz higher or lower. And now when you're turning the knob on the tuner, you get instant response because it doesn't have to go through the programming stage. Over.
Okay, that's a little bit like using a spectrum analyzer. As I use less and less sweep width, dispersion, as it's sometimes called, spread out. If I only care about what's happening at 3850 kilohertz, because that's where I'm about to operate to talk to my buddy during the schedule that's coming up, and I scan just 3800 to 3900, as I make that sweep width more and more narrow, I get an answer on that screen faster and faster, and eventually becomes real time. So if I make the sweep narrow enough, I'm getting a real time answer, and I can watch it move with my hand turning the knob on the antenna tuner, and I can almost instantaneously get there, is what I think you're saying. So in other words, it hops some number of kilohertz per second, and if I ask for less and less kilohertz of display, I get an answer that fills up the screen faster and faster. That sounds like a fun machine. K2KEY, K2RIW.
I bought a number of their rigs, their gadgets. They have that. They have the TDR and all. I have about three of them, different units that they've come out with. But what happens if you go to, like, say, zero, so that you're only looking at that frequency now, that one frequency, see a horizontal line, which is very nice, and a FWR scale. And what you're doing, you're moving the knob, you can actually see the horizontal line. Rather than looking at a meter, you're actually looking like it would be a horizontal sweep across the scope. And you actually, let's say you were using a scope for making a DC voltage, a DC measurement using the, you know, scope as a voltmeter. It looks the same way as you adjust the voltage. You can see the horizontal line on the scope moving up and down as the scope, of course, is set for DC, and that's exactly the way it looks. You see the SWR going up and down, and it gives you on the scale the readout. If you're going down, say, from 3 to 1 down, you know, you actually get instant response so that you can make, if you want to make, extremely fine adjustments to take over.
So I see what you do then to make yourself a graph. Most likely you move in 50 kilohertz steps when you make that graph for the dial settings, and since you've got a manual antenna tuner, I don't think you've went and bought an automatic one, at least not on every one of your rigs, you can go right straight to the tuning during a contest by your lookup chart, and you can QSY and be properly tuned almost immediately. Sounds like you got it made there, Mel. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Roger. Yeah, well, if you use it in the, as I say, open up the scan mode, 10, 25, 50, 100 kilohertz, then the line, instead of being a straight horizontal line, now becomes like you would see on a scope looking at a waveform. It goes up and down, shows you different dip spots on the dipole. It's amazing. Sometimes, you know, you just look at any antenna, and you, when you sweep it open, you would think that, let's say the antenna would, you know, display fairly, straight lines. But you should see, if you look at it, it's very interesting to see that on any antenna, no matter how fancy an antenna is, you see valleys, these dips up and down, some only, you know, not very shallow, but some spots, you just see some real pronounced dips. So it really gives you an analysis of the whole antenna at one time, if you want, Dick. Over.
Yeah, I think some of those local little squiggles in that normal bathtub-shaped curve could be a gutter that hits a hits a resonance at some frequency, or the reflection off something on the driveway. Minor little perturbations like that of signal coming out from the antenna, reflecting off something, and coming back. That's what I think you're seeing. So I think you're saying it's not always a smooth curve. A real antenna's got a couple of other funny wiggles in there, and it's quite possible AEA is telling you the truth. It's not just a glitch in the machine. That's what the antenna's really doing. And when in doubt, you can always put a calibrated dummy load on it, a 50-ohm resistor, a pair of 50-ohm resistors with a T-connector, so that's 25 ohms. That would be a calibrated 2-to-1. There's ways you can calibrate the machine rather easily with fixed resistors on the outside, and find out how accurate its display is. I bet you've done some of that already, Mel. K2RIW.
Oh, yes. In fact, you know what's interesting to do? Take any antenna and open it up. Let's say you bought out with an antenna for, I don't know, 20 meters, one frequency. And now you can open the sweep up into thousands of kilohertz, sweeping thousands of kilohertz. In other words, going through a good part of the HF band, right up to 6 meters. And you say, all of a sudden you see a spot that the goddamn thing, you say, what the heck? You mean to tell me my 20-meter antenna has got some spot where it will resonate somewhere in the 40-meter band or somewhere in the 10-meter or the 6-meter band? And it's strange, but you do see things like that. It's very fascinating to, you know, sometimes, like you say, just play around with it. Oh, of course, you put it on a dummy load. No, the line just stays perfectly straight. I've done that. I questioned it a few times, you know, and It's amazing what they were able to jam into this handheld gadget, Dick. It looks like a big VOM size. It's not a pocket thing, but comfortable enough to carry around easily in your hand, Dick, over.
That sounds like a fun machine to have. And if you're sweeping across your 20-meter beam, and you find out that it's got a nice low visual point somewhere in 6 meters, have you then ever gone to 6 meters and see if you could radiate into that antenna? No, go ahead.
But I've done it like, for instance, I think what heck happened, it resonated in the 20-meter beam, I think, once. I saw a resonance on, I don't remember what band, but I did go to that, and sure enough, it worked. But extremely critical. But it just showed that little valley, you know, that dip in some spot. And when you triangulate, find out where it is. It was amazing that it was this spot. And you know what else is very interesting? You take your beam with the analyzer set on, let's say, the band that the beam is set up for, and you start to rotate the beam, and you start seeing changes. You start seeing these little squiggly lines and things change. And I said, what in the heck is causing that? Is it really picking up, you know, reflections and things that are, quite a bit of way down from under the beam? Like, for instance, the 20-meter beam is at 85 feet. The house below it is, peak of the roof is about 35 feet. Am I actually seeing things that the way? But you do. Amazing that certain directions you see changes in the antenna system, showing you that there's still kind of reflections that Mother Earth is presenting or whatever is under it, Dick, over.
Fun stuff. Yep, with the right instrumentation, with somebody who understands the theory of what's going on, you can always do different things. And the word antenna is not a simple word. You properly study the real good books, like the fourth edition of the Antenna Engineering Handbook by Velasic, what's his name? All of a sudden, I can't think of the guy's name right now. There it is. Volakis, V-O-L-A-K-I-S, John Volakis. You look at the fourth edition of that Antenna Handbook and study those 50-some-odd chapters, you'll rapidly come to the conclusion there's about 5,000 kinds of antennas. Not a simple subject. And each one of them's got their crazy characteristics that take getting used to. So we amateurs, we don't build our transmitters anymore. When you and I first cut our teeth in ham radio back in the 50s, lots and lots of guys with homebrew transmitters. And some guys still do it today. Let me drop. When it comes to QRP rigs and other kits, Tentec kits and whatever, and Elecraft kits. But for the most part, we don't build our transmitters and our receivers. With a week's salary, you can buy something that's going to take you a year to build with your own hands, so it's not worth it. But when it comes to antennas, we still build antennas. At least a lot of us, the real experimenters, do. And boy, there's a zillion ways of doing it. Even though you think you've got a small piece of property, and you're forced to put the antenna in the apartment with you, in the attic above your condominium, on the roof of your house, in the backyard, above the garage, whatever the constraints are. There's a zillion ways you can put an antenna in what you think is a very constrained space if you do enough research on the available kinds of antennas. So don't give up on antennas. It's a fun place to experiment. Want to read another one, Mel? It's up to you. KQRIW.
Okay. Try another one. Here's one. I've had a number of these reoccurring ones like this, and there's caution here involved and things like that, but all right, here's one. I'd like to put up a dipole. In my backyard is the telephone lines run across telephone poles. I know I would not go near electric lines, but I know in the backyard the power lines for the house are in the front. The electric, the telephone lines are in the rear. Would the dipole work if it runs parallel to telephone cable, television cable, and things like that? There is no power lines except for things like these type of so-called low voltage lines and things. Can I put a dipole in that vicinity, even if I'm going to run low power. Now, you know, I question that, really, that any utility poles, whether or not to get involved with them too much, Dick, over.
It doesn't scare me, Mel. Without a doubt, you don't want your antenna anywhere near power wiring. You want lots and lots of feet between your antenna and any power wiring, because if your antenna comes in contact with Con Ed, Loco, New Jersey Power and Light, any Connecticut Power and Light, comes in contact with any of those power lines, you're in a heap of trouble. It's going to make an extremely dangerous condition, and there's a couple of hams every year somewhere in the United States that die because their antenna or the mast or the tower falls over and touches power wiring, so worry about that. However, if I had power lines going across the back of my property, and I want to string a 80-meter dipole parallel to that wire, and let me pick a number, 50 feet away from it, but parallel to it, and my antenna is going to be strung in the trees or whatever supports I've got, and it's at the exact same altitude as that power wiring 50 feet away, exact same altitude but parallel to it, or the telephone wiring, whatever kind of wiring. Common sense would lead you to believe that I'm going to get a great big blockage of the signal in that direction. Let's assume now that the back of my property runs north-south, and that power wiring is east of me, and I want to talk to my buddy in Africa that's due east, and you would think you're not going to get there. Don't give up that easily. Let me drop. If, for instance, you're on 80 meters, and you guys have probably heard me on this one before, think in an area relationship. A full 80-meter dipole, or even a zigzag narrow dipole, but a dipole on 80 meters has 8,500 square feet of radio area. If your eyes operated at 80 meters and you looked at that dipole when it's resonated, electronically resonated, whether you do it with the antenna tuner or the lens of the zigzag, doesn't matter, as long as it's resonant. You looked at it with your eyes, you would see a great big black oval in space with the wire down the middle of the oval as the long dimension, and that oval would have 8,500 square feet of area. When a signal comes in from space, or is being radiated by that wire, the signal coming in from space sees that 8,500 square feet of area. The majority of that signal in that black area ends up on the wire, goes down the feed line, and moves the S meter on your receiver. The wire of the power wiring or the telephone wiring that's parallel to you, 50 feet away, is not resonant on 80 meters. It casts a shadow of 1 or 2 square feet. So 1 or 2 square feet of shadow from the east, because of that power wiring, falls on the 8,500 square feet of your antenna, in my 80-meter example. Obviously, the gain loss because of that is going to be extremely minor. I will admit that if that power wiring happens to have an arcing power transformer or an arcing insulator, it's going to make some QR Nancy to you. And by way of a good noise blanker, let me drop. By way of a good noise blanker, you can get rid of that noise. But the average guy using common sense will think that that wire is going to cast a shadow. Because it's non-resonant, unless you're extremely unlucky, it is almost transparent. Radio is like that. None of the books I know say those words. I'm 99% sure that what I just said is a truth. I bet you've seen things like that and heard things like that with your experience, Mel. K2KEY, K2LIW.
Oh, yes, you hear that all the time, that they're going to pump all your RF is going to be absorbed by the power lines and the neutral lines. The neutral wire will is grounded, and goodbye, you're not going to do very much. Oh, yeah, I mean, this goes on and on. I mean, I don't even fight it anymore. I haven't even, in fact, my friends and I, we sort of get together, sort of, I don't have the regular schedules on 80, 75 meters anymore, because it wound up a few nights into verbal fist fights, to say the least, with a few of the people, because the discussions that we have here that they've listened to, and they find me, have found me on 75 meters a few times, and I told them that, yes, I said, for the most part, everything that we say is very accurate. I said, not just, I said, somewhat. I said, very accurate. It's been thought out and done by experimental, also proof. Yet, like you say, you're fighting sometimes an uphill battle with them, and it got so bad so many times that we just actually had to cut back our regular 75-meter operation, Dick. Let me let it drop. As far as putting up antennas on poles, utility poles and all, like Dick says, you know, be careful. I just can't emphasize enough because, you know, stay away as much as possible. I don't even want to think about fooling around with utilities because you never know, the wire gets away from you, a pole gets away from you, something gets in it and comes in contact with the power lines. And like Dick says, every year we read about hams that have been electrocuted. I know last year there was two father and sons that were electrocuted, putting up a vertical that fell across a power line. And it was amazing that it was a fiberglass type of vertical, and yet they were electrocuted. So it's nothing to fool around with high voltage that Con Ed or Viper or one of them produces on those lines. It's high voltage with high current. It will easily human beings, and the fact the electric lights in a house won't even blink. It's that much push behind it. It's immense. Nothing to fool with. I would say don't even consider, you know, even if you're not, even if you think you're sure, but you know, you can make a mistake and not know exactly what you're looking at sometimes, Dick, over.
Yeah, that is an awful sad way to go. The founder of the American Radio Relay, Hiram Percy Maxim, I think, I'm not sure, but I think the story is that the earphones he had on his head, the wiring came across, some high voltage wiring that was exposed, and I think that was the way that he passed away, by being electrocuted right through the ears, through high voltage wiring. So, we gotta be awful careful. The pot of wiring you've got in front of your house hits numbers like either 7,000 or 13,000 volts, line to ground or line to line, and that's capable of creating an awful lot of mischief. If you've ever seen a telephone pole that was hit by an automobile and the high tension wiring comes down to the ground and starts dancing around the ground and arcing, it'll give you some idea of what kind of destructive power it's got. It's something you really don't want to play with. So don't allow any of the metal of your antenna to come within any distance of power wiring where it can possibly make contact to it. Got to be awful careful about that. When you're setting up an antenna, plan on the worst case situation while you're raising the... while you're raising that pole or raising that wire, think about what will if it's in the worst possible.
Dick, just keep talking because I'm looking for this guy. Just keep talking. Don't stop, please. W-H-C-D-L.
Roger, Dodger. So just keep looking. Direction that antenna could possibly fall, and make sure there's no possibility it can touch power wiring. Okay, yeah, Mel, over to you. K2KEY, you want to read the next one? K2RIW?
Yeah,
bro. guess that gives you a clue as to where he's located. Mel, you want to go read the next one? K2KEY, K2LIW.
Here's the way we were. 12.
Great big sheet of copper to give you a mirror
where the other half of the dipole is the mirror image below ground. Whereas when the real radiator is half-wave, whether it be at ground level or above ground level, I think is capable of a lot more performance, doesn't have anywhere near as much requirement for a whole lot of ground plane radials. It doesn't require the ground to be a perfect sheet of copper anymore to give high performance. I think that's somewhat what you and I have been saying, and my guess is a manufacturer of a quarter-wave multi-band ground plane antenna is taking us to task, saying that we're being too severe. Is that somewhat what you've heard so far, Mel? K2KEY, KQRIW?
And this is K2KEY, yep, that's basically, in fact, we even made that statement, which you just made again about putting down the radials and all, and they're selling verticals that cover 80 through 10 meters, and claiming that no radial, additional radials required, that they have a so-called counterpoise that hangs off the pipe, which is just a small rectangular type of thing that only contains maybe 12 feet of wire. That's all that's sufficient as their counterpoise. And that antenna will outperform any of the dipoles or any of the so-called more elaborate quarter-wave verticals that you put down a heck of a lot of radial. And I severely question that, Dick, over.
Yes, so do I. And a person manufacturing that antenna may truly believe what he's saying, and the person using the antenna may believe it, because the average amateur does not have the ability to measure antenna efficiency. He can measure standing wave ratio across the band. He can measure receiving characteristics, but real transmitting efficiency, whether or not the antenna is radiating 90% of its power into the air or 80% of its power into the earth around it because there's not enough ground plane radials, the average amateur cannot tell the difference. And he may be reasonably happy with his quarter wave ground plane with a small number of radials, and many of the manufacturers only ask for 4, 6, or 8 radials, a rather small number, because that's enough to give you a good standing wave ratio reading. That's what the amateur can measure. The amateur can't measure efficiency, so everything seems to be hunky-dory. And if the manufacturer of the antenna had requested 32 ground plane radials, some people would be very resistant to that. They wouldn't buy that antenna. And until the amateur who puts down the 4 radials puts up simultaneously another dipole at some reasonable altitude and compares the performance, until he does that comparison, he's going to think everything's hunky-dory on antenna efficiency. And being that low in phase center on the ground, behind the building, so to speak, with not enough ground plane radials, a very attractive-looking quarter-wave ground plane, somewhat expensive antenna, could, in some cases, in some environments, be relatively low in performance by comparison to an inexpensive, simple dipole at a higher altitude. And the dipole itself, let me drop. At first, the amateur is resistant to put up the dipole because he thinks, gee, it only works on one band, and this ground plane structure works on 3, 4, 5, 6 bands. That's he's way ahead of the game to have this multi-band ground plane thing. And it isn't that difficult to put up a fan dipole where the dipole works on all of those bands with rather inexpensive materials. Until the amateur puts up that dipole and does the comparison of signal strength and the signal reports he gets from the people he talks to, until he does that comparison, may not know what kind of efficiency he's really getting. That's a set of opinions based on my experience, and you're a guy with a whole lot of ground plane radial, so in your case, a ground plane vertical quarter wave thing can work quite well. But you're the guy, though, that was lucky enough to have somebody digging up the street and you laid down a whole lot of wires while that was done. Very few of us have got those kind of resources. K2KEY, K2RIW.
This is K2KEY. Yeah, that was an unusual break. Once in a lifetime. I'm sure I'd never see that again. And I always say to myself, gee, I wonder how many of them are still there that haven't, I don't know, I don't think they deteriorate because, you know, that wire had that plastic coating on it, copper wires. I'm sure they're still, most of them still intact. Well, this is the point, what you just said. This is what's causing a lot of the controversy. The comment, and I wasn't going to go any further with it, but I'll just put it in a quick comment here. It's a whole lengthy thing, but I'm going to just read one little comment here that you do not understand. You, meaning the six NATO, do not understand elevated feed. That's what the comment, I say no more, Dick. I think it's a hot potato, and it will never get to solve it over.
Yeah, there are various kinds of antennas where instead of feeding the radiating structure right at the bottom, you've got the feed point displaced vertically up higher on the radiating structure. There are various kinds of ground planes that do that. Yes, it makes some improvement, but how much extra altitude are you getting? What that means, if I've got a tall enough tree in the backyard, theory I could set up a vertical or horizontal dipole in that tree 30, 40, 50, 60 feet in the air. The elevated feed point type ground planes antennas slightly decrease the performance requirement of the ground plane radials. As the antenna structure that does the radiating, as the portion that does the radiating, approaches half wave electronically in length, then you rapidly get to the point where the feed point at the bottom impedance climbs to numbers like 2,000 ohms. Your phase center is now significantly raised in the air. And whether I make a half-wave radiator, if I've got the real estate to do that, vertical real estate, if I make that half-wave radiator and feed it in the center and call it an elevated feed point, or don't even put a gap in the center and feed it at the bottom, the performance will be almost identical. As you go to half-wave, now the antenna becomes its own counterpoise. A half-wave dipole has its own counterpoise. The left-hand side is the counterpoise for the right-hand side, and vice versa. Your transmission line and transmitter, let me drop, is acting like a pump, and it's pumping electrons from the left side to the right side of the dipole, and back again. That's how it works. So each side is the counterpoise for the other. And when you build a ground plane radial system with quarter-wave radiator, you're now pumping electrons from the counterpoise, the ground plane rods, you have ground plane radioles into the radiator. And you're pumping the current back and forth, and as such, you're feeding quite a bit of current into Earth, unless you've got a lot of those ground plane radioles. And as you make that radiator, the vertical section is doing the radiating, closer and closer to half wave or 5/8 wave, you are creating a phase center above Earth. And whether you feed it in that center or feed it at the bottom, to repeat myself, doesn't matter. The performance will be pretty much the same. But there's a lot to be said with a half wave radiator, whether it's horizontal or vertical or on the ground plane. There are guys who have put up a half wave radiator made out of a spiral wound thing on fiberglass, use nothing as a counterpoise but the railing on the balcony of their apartment at the 20th floor of an apartment building, and had fantastic performance. You don't need much of a ground plane radial system when it's highly elevated away from the Earth or as it approaches half wave in radiator length. These are my opinions. The rate at which you get improvement, as I took a quarter wave radiator section and feed it at the bottom, one quarter away from the bottom